Good evening. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. China, the miracle of China these last 20 years. The United States, trading partner with China, watching this boom as it continues, 10%, 9%, 8%. And now we hit a puzzle. Where is China in 10 years or 5 years from now? There are indications that the future for Beijing is Tokyo. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com joins me. Gordon, a very good evening to you. Saying the future is Tokyo, that's not good news, is it, Gordon?
No, it's not good news, because Tokyo, Japan, had a crash in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and then it had two decades of stagnation, either recession or really very, very slow growth. And that could very well be the future of another country that refuses to make an adjustment.
Fraser Howey, the co-author of Red Capitalism, The Fragile Financial Foundation of China's Extraordinary Rise, joins us from Singapore. A very good morning to you, Fraser. The future is Tokyo. How do we translate that for the present? It hasn't happened yet. Why are the conditions ripe for stagnation, stagflation, a burst of a bubble, and why are also conditions avoidable? Good evening. Good morning to you.
Good evening, John Garden. The conditions are right because ultimately the course that China has been following economically, the model it's followed, has largely run aground and run out of steam. And that to move to the next phase of growth requires a real fundamental change of their policies. And the difficulty is, do they have ultimately the balls to carry through those changes? Japan's been in 20 years of stagnation largely through choice, because they refused to make tough, difficult reforms that struck at the heart of the Japanese political economy. And therefore, that's why they've got these problems now and why it's lasted so long. Japan's had the benefit of being a much richer country than China, so it's had a much bigger cushion. Also, it hasn't had a lot of the social and political fractious issues that China has. So in China's case, you have an aging population, you have a slowing growth economy, you have a political system that is completely unable to change. And then you look at all these things and you think almost the best scenario for China is one of stagnation of sorts. It can still grow. It's still ultimately a poor country. And so therefore, coming from a low base, you can still get high growth rates by Western standards. But the idea of China growing even at 8% for the next decade is wildly optimistic. And the idea of 10% growth is just never going to happen anymore.
Gordon?
Fraser, you know, everyone says that there needs to be substantial structural reform in the Chinese economy. And yet, when we look at the Chinese political system, you pointed out the system is not able to reform itself. This is a system that hasn't had a really big reform since China joined the WTO, which was in 2001, which was really a decision made in 1998, 1999. Why do people think that there will be now the consensus to have structural reforms when we haven't seen it for more than a decade?
Well, I think that there is a growing feeling that the model has run aground, and I think a lot of it is wishful thinking, frankly, and the belief that somehow there's these great, smart Chinese leaders in power who know what to do and will grasp the nettle. I think a lot of those optimists are simply misplaced. That just because China needs to reform does not mean it's going to reform, because it isn't simply just economics here and changing a few rates or opening up a few more funding channels. There's a fundamental issue here of how the party is basically this network, this web that runs throughout the economy in China, of preferential treatment for large SOEs, how the politics and economics fits together. Breaking that mold is going to be extremely difficult. And I often have talked about the last decade being a lost decade for China. Forget the ones to come, but the past decade has been a lost decade, even though it's been phenomenal growth. Because the difficult choices weren't made when things were going well. It would have been much easier to make tough choices when you had very strong growth. Now you've got falling growth, much more social unrest, much more sort of global concern about China. That's a very difficult time to make difficult choices.
Fraser, is it significant that China's 10 times, more than 10 times the size of Japan? And also, I mentioned, Japan has Honda and Toyota, to mention two products that America's happy to buy. I can't think of anything comparable in China after all this growth that America wants to buy. What do they make that we need that we can't buy elsewhere?
Well, that's partly true. Of course, that seems ridiculous in some ways when you look at everything in your kitchen or wherever and it has made in China stamped at the bottom. But of course, it really means assembled in China. And so much of those exports are assembly driven. They're not Chinese intellectual property. They're not Chinese branded goods per se. And while China has competed on cost on many of those projects, you ultimately don't have a lot of wealth creation. For all that trade that goes through Chinese ports, the actual accrual to China and the Chinese society and the Chinese worker is relatively low. So you have, that's just another aspect where Japan has been able to, you know, waste two decades in some ways and yet still remain relatively affluent. Still, Tokyo is one of the world's richest cities, still a very dynamic and vibrant place because they have had real things that people want to buy and they've been able to compete globally. Chinese companies are nowhere near ready to do that, which makes all the tougher for China.
Gordon?
Fraser, you talked about the slowdown in growth. If we look at Chinese growth rates, they claimed 10.4% in 2010, may have even been higher than that. Now they're talking about 7.5% growth, but I think that it's probably in the low single digits. Really, China has this issue of deceleration, and that's difficult for any economy to take, rich or poor, don't you think?
Yes, I would totally agree. I think always the key thing to remember our old Soviet history, was always double the good news, half the bad. And I think that when you're looking at, that's too crude a measure just for simply official GDP numbers, but that's the sort of thing to be remembered when you're talking about GDP. So whether we even trust the numbers is one thing, but you're absolutely right. No economy performs well and responds as you hope in a decelerating environment. That's very difficult to manage.
A political question, Fraser, and I ask it cautiously. You say there are reforms that will help or ease or shorten this period of correction in China. But can the model they have, the Chinese Communist Party, top-down, command, strong hand, even a boot on the throat in most instances, can that reform? I thought the deal was, the grand bargain, the devil's deal 20 years ago, we give you growth and you give us obedience. So can they change that bargain just to change the economic model?
Well, what I would say is if you're looking for serious political reform at the Communist Party level, no, they cannot change. There's no indication that political reform, as we understand it, a plurality of ideas and acceptance of different views of discussion in the public space, I don't see in any way that that is changing. Greater accountability in the party is not coming because you simply, the structure doesn't allow for it. What the party could be able to do and will likely be able to do is mitigate the worst effects of some of this contraction and this deceleration. At least they will be able to support certain industries. They will be able to kick the can down the road. They're never going to force industries to wholesale declare bankruptcy or anything like that. So if we're expecting a Lehman Brothers moment of a Chinese bank just saying, look, our loan book's a shambles, we're going under, that's not going to happen. They will take all measures they can to try and support and mitigate the worst effects. But the idea that there's real change coming from the leadership, as we would understand it, absolutely not.
Gordon?
Yeah, Fraser, I agree with you that they will not allow a major state enterprise or a major state bank to fail. What is important, though, is that they don't necessarily determine how people think, though. And really, this comes down to a question of confidence. As long as people maintain confidence in the leadership of the Chinese government to manage the economy, things will be okay, no matter how bad the structure is. But once people lose confidence, then you have all sorts of things going haywire, and I don't think the leaders will be able to deal with it in that circumstance.
Yes, I think that's right. The question, of course, and this is where it's always difficult to play any scenario analysis, what is the thing that breaks the confidence, that where the confidence is lost? And that's not clear to me. We can all come up with various scenarios, but it may be there are so many sort of tipping points in China, whether it could be, you know, whether it be social unrest aspects, environmental issues, could be corruption issues, a whole slew of things. It's very difficult to know where that tipping point comes. But you're right. At the moment, there's a lot of confidence in the sense that there's a belief still that the government somehow can control enough of things and it won't let it collapse. And I think that's right. That's the right view. It doesn't necessarily make it a particularly profitable investment to invest in China on the back of that view, but it probably mitigates the worst scenarios. And it certainly mitigates a sort of 1998 Russian collapse type of scenario. Let's forget a 1989 Russian collapse or Soviet collapse. But you certainly, you know, you're not heading for a default in China at the national level. You're not looking for vast flows of money out of China. I don't see that necessarily happening and precipitating a collapse.
Gordon, Fraser Howey is the co-author of Red Capitalism, The Fragile Financial Foundation of China's Extraordinary Rise. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. Fraser is in Singapore. Gordon's in North America traveling. I'm John Batchelor. John Batchelor, my colleague and co-host Gordon Chang of Forbes.com joins me, traveling in North America. Breaking news. The very influential Institute for Science and International Security in Washington reports to the New York Times, it's breaking news on your website right now, that North Korea appears to have doubled the size of the area used to enrich uranium at the Yongbyon reactor complex in recent months. This, according to the report from Washington on Tuesday. This looks at satellite images of Yongbyon complex and compares it to previous satellite images. This was a mothballed nuclear reactor at Yongbyon. You will recall it has a long and checkered history of negotiating on and off. But right now, the interpretation by David Albright, the authors David Albright and Robert Avagyan, on this study is that the announcement earlier this spring from North Korea that is now declared an oblique effort to reveal this new construction. At the time, it was missed by analysts, but now we understand they're growing their nukes. We're joined now by our colleague in Seoul. This is Greg Scarlatou, Executive Director for the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. Greg, a very good morning to you. Is this commonplace knowledge that North Korea is growing its reactor complex at Yongbyon? Good morning.
A very good evening to you, John. It is a well-known fact by now that North Korea has been working both on its plutonium-based program and its uranium-based program. Experts generally agree that North Korea, by means of plutonium reprocessing, has been able to build about 8 nuclear devices. What is truly a matter of grave concern about the uranium enrichment program is that, first of all, it presents much greater potential for proliferation by North Korea to rogue actors around the world. And also, it is more difficult to detect this type of program, uranium enrichment, from by means of aerial surveillance. So, in other words, it's easier to hide. Of course, we know that the area has expanded in size twice, but of course, we're not sure of each and every location where this activity is taking place. North Korea has clearly signaled that it wants to be acknowledged as a nuclear power, a nuclear-armed state, and North Korea has continued to threaten its neighbors in the entire region, in particular South Korea and Japan, with the development of its nuclear program. So this is a matter of very grave concern.
Gordon?
Greg, you talked about proliferation of nuclear materials and technology to rogues. The important point here, I think, is that Iran also has a uranium-based program, and that probably this North Korean uranium program is something that the Iranians probably are interested in because they can now share technology. So here what we have is a double threat, not just North Korea, but it's also Iran. How do you view this?
I think that the big problem with a uranium enrichment program is that the supply can basically be unlimited. This is not the case with a plutonium extraction program, for example. So I think that it's there is a well-established track record of collaboration between North Korea and Iran, in particular on ballistic missiles. North Korea has sold the Musudan to Iran. And the one place where the Musudan was tested was Iran. And in this case, once again, we all recall the Israeli nuclear strike on a reactor located in Syria in 2007. There were credible reports that there are nuclear experts, North Korean nuclear experts, on the ground at that reactor, and that the actual structure of the reactor had a striking resemblance to the North Korean nuclear reactor in Yongbyon. And this type of reactor and the architecture inside the reactor is not common at all, or hasn't been very common for the past 50 years or so.
Greg, quickly, there's a report, this is BBC, that 2 million people inside North Korea, this darkened land that you can see from satellites, has no electricity at night except for in a few pockets, 2 million mobile phones. Does that mean that they can hear about this report about the Yongbyon complex growing?
Absolutely not. What is interesting about the adoption of new technologies in North Korea is that they do that while continuing to severely restrict access to information from the outside world. Yes, indeed, Orascom Telecom, the Egyptian company, has established this network called Koryolink in North Korea. They might have 2 million subscribers, but North Koreans cannot place calls outside the borders of North Korea. They cannot make international calls on these cell phones. They cannot call foreigners residing in North Korea, for example, employees of the UN office there. An employee of the UN office cannot call his or her North Korean driver on his cell phone simply because the two systems do not connect. It has always been very expensive to have a landline in North Korea. Landlines have always been the subject of strict surveillance by North Korea's internal security agencies, by the State Security Department in particular. This is an agency that has 50,000 employees. The Ministry of Public Security has 210,000 employees. Why do the North Koreans proceed with the cell phone system? I see three main reasons. First and foremost, it looks good outside the country. It gives the impression that, after all, North Korea also has a cell phone system. They may not be so different from the outside world. Reason number two is that basically those who have the cell phones are senior officials, the most trusted and loyal members of the North Korean elite, and also those engaged in import-export operations, a big money-making enterprise that can be pursued only if one has government approval to do so. And those who are active on North Korea's black market, this informal market that has developed in North Korea after the famine of the 1990s as a coping mechanism, as a survival mechanism. So the government can not only conduct surveillance of these people, but the government can also extract some cash in the process, because these cell phones, as you can see, are not at all cheap. It costs basically about, according to recent reports, 100 British pounds for a basic phone, and up to 250 for a latest model touchscreen phone. However, what we also need to keep in mind is that one cannot access the internet through these mobile phones in North Korea. There's a limited number.
Greg Scarlato, Executive Director for the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. Suppose you had an iPhone and it only called a monster. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. My colleague, Gordon Chang of Forbes.com, is traveling in North America. And we're joined by Malcolm Ouslin of the American Enterprise Institute, writing most recently in the National Review Online. Before we go to China, we're going to pause in the Windy City. This is Chicago. Michael has a piece up looking to the near future about Chicago. Michael, I mentioned that while we discuss the slide of the economic miracle in Beijing, the disappointment of the most recent numbers, we're looking past the problems in large, very famous American cities. Detroit now is Chapter 9 bankruptcy. Who knows what the future is? It's been shrinking for some time. Your piece at NRO points to troubles in Chicago. Rahm Emanuel's mayor, The governor of the state, Mr. Quinn, Governor Quinn, is very disposed to Cook County. What can go wrong and why in Chicago? Good evening to you, Michael.
Good evening, John. Well, look, you know, the fear I have, at least, is that Chicago is going to be the next domino to fall. We have Detroit, and a few years ago, people thought Detroit couldn't fall. 10 years ago would have seemed inconceivable. You have hundreds of billions of dollars of unfunded pension liabilities in both California and the state of Illinois. You know, the insolvency is creeping throughout the country, and Chicago was just downgraded 3 notches by Moody's. They may, in 2 years, if they don't start tackling their unfunded pension liability problem themselves, they're going to have a $1 billion debt shortfall or debt problem on top of a $300 million budget shortfall. So all of these arguments that, you know, it can never happen here, well, it is starting to happen here.
And just to follow through on Chicago right now, is this alarm bell ringing in Chicago, or are we just, we're outside of it and just saying, the numbers don't work, but they're not worrying?
It's starting. In fact, the when Moody's downgraded them, it actually came out of a report that was done by City Hall. So this is an official Rahm Emanuel City Hall report on the pension liabilities issue. And of course, it's related to what he was trying to do against the teachers unions last year. They are aware of it. And when I was there all of last week, and it was all in the front pages, made the front page of the New York Times today or yesterday. So I think they're hearing it. You know, Chicago is not Detroit. It's not a one industry town. It's a lot more diverse. Obviously, it's bigger, but that doesn't mean that the fundamentals and economic reality and gravity aren't going to cause the same problems. And potentially, if you've got to start plugging your budget gap by cutting city services, that's what put Detroit on the death spiral. And Chicago can be facing that if they don't get their act together.
Let's travel half a world away, because Gordon and I this evening, Michael, have been discussing odd signs out of China that not only is the denialism quavering about the economic slide, not collapse, but a slide, the recent numbers, but also there's been strange aggression by the new regime, the new leadership. One is various reports. Gordon, I need to check with you again. There were reports that the Chinese language website of the WSJ was blocked by the Great Firewall. There have also been reports that the New York Times and the Bloomberg news sites have been blocked, but then they come back on. Is that all correct, Gordon? On, off, on, off.
That's right. And what's important here is there's not the blocking of a single story on the Wall Street Journal's Chinese language website. It's the whole website has now become unavailable. That is something that hasn't happened in the past, as far as we know.
And Michael, we need an interpretation here. Watching China, the Chinese miracle these last 20 years, the American administrations, both parties, have been very disposed to helping the miracle. But these recent signs, and Gordon and I have talked about them with you before, the aggression in the East China Sea and the South China Sea along the Indian border, we could go on here. Is there something fundamental that's changing right in front of us, Michael?
Well, I think, John, if you sense that the leadership is now starting to get very worried about the economic downturn, and that they're feeling pressure, you know, things are not going necessarily the way they want in places like the seas you mentioned. For example, Japan unveiled a huge aircraft carrier. It's actually supposedly a helicopter carrying destroyer yesterday. If they're starting to sense pushback, then I think what we're seeing on the domestic side makes sense to me. It's that they are worried ever more about alternative views getting out, seeping into the population. They're not being able to control it on sites like Sina Weibo and the like, and therefore they're getting a lot more assertive in terms of clamping down on information than they have before. And of course, since they never get punished for it, they're willing to press until they finally run up against some resistance.
Gordon?
Michael, this is really interesting. We see China going off the rails in so many different ways. We see an economy which is in obvious distress. We see this increased censorship of economic sites. We see China's more aggressiveness towards Japan, India, the Philippines. It just seems that China is producing a lot of bad news recently, and although we may not be able to connect it precisely, it seems that there has to be something. This can't be a coincidence. I mean, can it?
No, I mean, I don't think so, and it's part of the problem is that what we look at, and we see, you know, Gordon, and you look at it all the time, are these really fundamental rifts that are occurring in society. You know, it is still a very large country. It's still controlled, you know, and the government still controls, and the party controls the levers of power. To get to the real breaking point is something that I still think is going to take some time. What we're not watching is all of the movements, all of the currents that are bringing us much closer to that. And instead, you know, you just get very superficial coverage of you know, China still growing and still having, you know, the ability to continue producing and being a wealth magnet. And for anyone who travels there, or anyone who talks to people who are dealing there, things are becoming much more uncertain now.
Michael, is there an understanding in Washington that China is no longer a happy all the time story? Is there a perception that the economic slide is not the same as a slide in Europe? This isn't an ordinary recession. That the governance has made this deal with the people these last 20 years, we'll grow and you obey. But now that that's broken, the government doesn't have an act two. They don't have another way of doing it. They're going to force obedience, and the people recognize that the equation doesn't work.
John, I think that your question about whether Washington and folks in Washington are starting to get that is, the answer is yes, but it hasn't translated into policy. I think when you, if you talk to people in the White House or in State Department, Commerce, they understand a lot of what's happening. Maybe they don't, you know, they don't have the entire picture. I don't think anybody has the entire picture. But then they'll turn around and they'll do things like the Sunnyland Summit or the Strategic and Economic Dialogue, and it doesn't translate into policy. We're acting as though it's the China of 2002 or 2005 or whatever year you want to pick, and not the China of today. But when you step away from that, people are starting to scratch their heads, partly to because they don't fully understand what's happening, but partly because they also don't know where's it going to lead. Meaning, you know, are we going to get caught unawares? Are we suddenly going to wake up one day and you have a collapse of this party because there's absolutely no legitimacy to it anymore, or some massive outbreak in the rural areas that catches everyone by surprise? So I would say Washington is pretty schizophrenic about it all right now.
Gordon?
Yeah, Michael, I'd have to agree with you. I think that, you know, if you go back to the Nixon trip, everyone's been trying to integrate China into the international system, and everyone's just afraid to think about the next question is, what if the Chinese don't want to be integrated? What if the Chinese want to upset the international system? And it seems to me that there's a lot of denial going on in the place where you live and work.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. I don't think there's anyone who would disagree with the that, you know, denial is the motif of life in Washington in many ways. Certainly it's, you know, it's what's causing all the economic problems here. No one wants to deal with it, and they're afraid of having to deal with a problem called China. I think people here instinctively understand that it would be a massive upset to the international system, both economically and potentially security and politically, that because of our alliance relations in Asia, we might be called upon to do some very serious heavy lifting out there if, as always has happened in the past, unrest in China spills out into the rest of Asia. So I think Washington is a place that it has so many fires to try and put out every day that the fear is that they feel something big might be coming on, and they don't have the bandwidth to deal with it.
100 years, of course, have passed since we worried about Asia, Russia versus Japan, and what is to be done, the open-door policy in China. Those fears were all legitimate, Michael. I've recently read a book about a biography of John Hay. He died in 1905, but he died the last weeks worrying not just about the Panama Canal, but the open-door policy and whether there was going to be peace. And eventually, Teddy Roosevelt got the Nobel Peace Prize for negotiating a peace between the Russian Empire and the rising Japanese Empire. Every one of those concerns turned into a world war, depredations, and mass murder. Michael, I just mentioned that because we're not wrong-headed to think that's our history in Asia. When we flag these large problems, it gets worse, not better.
Well, that, you know, I think, John, that it's a great point, and maybe that's why a lot of people are wondering if this is a real turning point in Asian history. Meaning, everything you've said about the past is absolutely right. And yet you still have a lot of people who believe, you know, the sort of neoliberal view that economic integration makes conflict much less likely. And you see all these countries, including China, Philippines, Vietnam, run right up to the edge and then tiptoe back because ultimately they're afraid of really upsetting the apple cart. In addition to that, you have far more, and I think it's, you know, pretty indisputable, you do have far more multilateral mechanisms throughout the region, much more talking, much more getting together. I don't necessarily think that that obviously doesn't solve everything. I don't necessarily think that it changes the feelings countries have to each other, but it does change the way that they interact. So the question is this a fundamental change point? Can Asia skip what Europe had to go through, which was two horrific world wars that basically destroyed European civilization, in order to get to a functioning European community? And can Asia more or less avoid that, except, you know, Japan's attempt to create an empire, but that's a little bit different, I would argue, than what Europe did in tearing itself apart. If so, then this will be an era in which there's great uncertainty leading ultimately to some level of community. And if not, then history will triumph and we'll wind up realizing that everything we assumed was not only wrong, we had prepared, we'd bet on the wrong horse, and we were unprepared for the massive devastation that ultimately followed.
Michael Ouslin is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com is with me as my colleague and co-host from another part of North America. And we're joined now by our colleague, Joseph Sternberg of the Asia Wall Street Journal. He is in Hong Kong this morning. Joseph is the business editor. And there's a new column up by Manami Funakoshi, who is the Robert Bartley Fellow at the Wall Street Journal. That means a summer internship-like job at the editorial page. I understand from Joseph that Ms. Funakoshi is an American citizen, yes, and she was born overseas, I believe in the subcontinent, and she has two more years at Yale College. Good for her. And she's writing about daycare and the wish for the Japanese government to fix daycare from the top. Gordon and Joseph, I want to flag the fact that it is my mind that the President of the United States, not the Prime Minister of Japan, Mr. Abe, but the President of the United States was recently either in Illinois mentioning babysitting run by the federal government, or in Tennessee mentioning the same thing, also a head start to 4 years old. So this impulse to fix daycare, childcare from the top is not just in Tokyo, it is also in Washington. Joseph, what's wrong with the central government taking control of babysitting? Good morning to you.
Hi, John. Well, our Bartley fellow Manami has hit on a really fascinating case study of Japan today. I mean, daycare is one of these policy fixations that Tokyo has had for years now. Both parties have talked about it. The theory is that if you could just provide better daycare to more children, then, you know, it would be easier for women to re-enter the workforce after they've started families. And, you know, you might even encourage more young couples to start having children, and you could reverse Japan's population decline. And yet Tokyo never seems to fix it, and it's because they haven't been able to get out of their long-standing mindset on this issue, which is that the government has to control as much of it as possible. You know, you have to have these deep subsidies to deal with the high price problem instead of encouraging the market to create more supply of daycare. In fact, they very highly regulate private companies that would want to invest in daycare centers, making it difficult for them to gather the capital to build more of these centers. So it's just an example of how even when Tokyo hits on a problem that is arguably a problem, it is so hard for them to get out of this old, top-down mindset and actually start fixing it.
Gordon?
Well, Joseph, couldn't they kill two birds with one stone here? First of all, the government is pouring all these money into daycare centers, which can't be inexpensive. And they've got a debt problem anyway. And second of all, is, as you point out, if they allow the market to decide these things, you'd have more daycare available, and it probably would be cheaper. So you get a twofer here, don't you?
Exactly, which is why, in a sense, it's so puzzling that they haven't done that. I mean, the government is spending huge amounts of money subsidizing these daycare places, and in fact, Abe has promised to pour even more money into it, over the coming years, to try to build more centers. It never works. It's the same problem that you have whenever the government is going to provide any kind of service like this. The quality starts to decline. The government can never marshal resources as efficiently as the private sector could to deliver both more places and higher quality. But, you know, they end up in a bit of a political bind here, because the parents who already have children in daycare, you know, the ones who are not languishing on a long waiting list, enjoy having the ultra-cheap daycare that the government subsidy provides. So, you know, it shows that even when you have a bad policy, you often have some kind of constituency out there for it, which makes it really difficult to change.
Joseph, this suggests that the Abe government doesn't really understand the marketplace, that it hesitates, it's hedging, it talks the good game, but when it comes to policies like this, it's just the same as it always was.
Well, I think that's a bigger criticism that you can make about Abenomics, and this is the conclusion I'm increasingly coming to about Abe's broader economic reform programs. If you look at the details, there is not a lot of radical, market liberalization thinking, maybe with the exception of his plan to do free trade by trying to join the Trans-Pacific Partnership. If you look through the details of his structural reform package, a lot of it is, saying we'll try to do what the government's been doing all along, but we'll just try to do it a little better. You know, maybe if we target the subsidies a little more narrowly, maybe if we do a better job of offering an incentive for this thing or that thing, then it'll work. I mean, not the bold thinking that Japan really needs.
Gordon?
Joe, this is like about 3 weeks after the upper house elections, where the Liberal Democratic Party and its coalition partner won a resounding majority. So now, basically, Abe controls both houses of the Diet. Have we really heard anything? You know, you talk about Abenomics. We've been talking about this before, about the third arrow in the quiver, which is structural reform. We haven't really had any big announcements of structural reform, have we? I mean, really what we're having is a very disappointing period. Now that Abe has all this political capital, he doesn't seem to be using it.
I think that's absolutely a fair point. And the big debate in Tokyo right now is whether Abe is going to go ahead with increasing the consumption tax. And as we argued in an editorial in the journal out here this week, I mean, the problem is that they talk about increasing the consumption tax as something that's really necessary to get their fiscal train back on the track. But again, that is a real missed opportunity to talk about other tax reforms that they could have done that would both be good for revenue and start fixing some of the bad incentives in the existing tax code. So really, Abenomics is turning out to be a story of an awful lot of missed opportunities.
Joseph, right now, we discussed earlier this evening the possibility that China's future is going to look like Japan's. Will you help the audience understand what that means? What has Japan been in these last 20 years that Abenomics may be the answer to?
Well, I think that, China has followed a lot of the policies that Japan tried to do, and a lot of other Asian economies have too, Taiwan and Korea. What Japan has discovered, though, is that there is a limit to the ability of policies, geared toward investment at the expense of domestic consumption, of a very corporatist political system. There's a limit of the ability of that system to continue delivering growth. Now, Japan is lucky that they reached a developed world level of per capita growth before they hit that ceiling. You know, the Koreans have hit the ceiling much earlier and are now facing a lot of debates about how to turn the ship around. China might hit that ceiling earlier still in terms of their level of development. And so the question is going to be, do the politicians know what to do and have the will to do hard reforms to upset the existing system? And I'm more pessimistic about that in China than just about anywhere else.
Joseph Sternberg is the business editor of the editorial page of the Asia Wall Street Journal in Hong Kong. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. Minami Funakoshi, writing about daycare in Japan. I'm John Batchelor.